Welcome to another episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and our guest today is Lanny Swerdlow, who is the owner of the iconic City Nightclub in Portland, Oregon. We'll also be talking about some of his other bar memories. So welcome to the show, Lanny.
It's an honor and a thrill to be here.
And it's great to have you here. It's our project has been attempting to record memories of gay bars, most of which are no longer with us. And I've documented about 1,500 of them across the country so far. But I understand you have a bar experience. Your first bar experience goes back to sunny Los Angeles, California. Why don't you tell us about that a little bit?
Well, I was in college. I mean, I had known I was attracted to guys for a long, long time. And I never did anything about it, really, other than fooling around with a couple friends of mine. And I knew, you know, it was really tragic. I there's very few things I resent in my life. But one of the things I resent most of all is that it took me so long to come out. I lost all my teenage years of sexuality. And I knew I could have gone up to Hollywood Boulevard because, you know, but I never had the guts to do it. So when I was in college, though, I finally began to realize I had to do something about it. And I went to California State College in Los Angeles. And so I went to the psychology. I went to get some counseling about the fact that I was gay and what should I do about it. And the counselor I had was a student in the psychology department who turned out to also be gay. And he said, well, basically, you just got to try it and find out. And he told me the name of a gay bar in Los Angeles he thought would fit me very well. And he told me exactly what, you know, kind of gave me an idea of what I should wear so I would feel comfortable. And the place he told me about was the Stampede on Santa Monica Boulevard in Los Angeles. And so I went there. I can't remember what night it was. It was probably a weekend night. It was very busy. And I was very, very nervous. But I went in and I ordered a beer, which I don't drink beer. So I just held on to this one beer glass the entire time I was there. After about an hour or so, I was standing next to this guy. And this other guy walked by and he was kind of looking around. And I kind of said to him, gee, I wonder what he's looking for. And he says, on the floor, because he was looking down. And that kind of broke the ice. And I wound up going home with him. And we kind of became boyfriends for a while.
Now, to put this in perspective, because a lot of our viewers are a little bit younger. I know I'm behind.
Yeah, this was 50 years ago.
This was before 50 years ago. Before Stonewall.
Yes.
So everybody knows when Stonewall was, and they think this is a big breaking point. But you actually went to your first gay bar in Los Angeles about a year before Stonewall happened.
Here's a even more interesting point. After I went to that bar and I saw this guy for stuff, I graduated from college. And my parents gave me a graduation present of a bus ticket out of town. And what I did was I had a little Dameron's guy. I'm sure you're familiar with the Dameron's guy.
Absolutely.
And back then, the Dameron's guy was about the size of a business card, and it had maybe 15, 20 pages in it. And very small type, they had each city in there with a listing of a bar with a number of, with some letters after it, which would tell you what kind of a crowd it had. C for collegiate, Y for young, L for lesbian, this kind of stuff. And so what I did was, which you could do on a bus trip back then, I imagine you can still do it, is the bus trip went all the way from Los Angeles to New York. And you could stop anywhere in between and get off the bus, stay for as long as you wanted to, and catch the next bus through and go on. So what I would do is I would go to a city like Detroit, and I would get into the bus station, and I would put my luggage into one of those lockers there. And then that evening, I would go to one of the bars that was in the Dameron guide. And I would get picked up and I would stay with the person who picked me up for usually as long as I wanted to stay in the city. And I met some really interesting people. And I don't remember too much about the bars except for one. This was in 1968. And I remember going to Stonewall. And it was quite a trip. It was really something. It was a very exciting place. Dingy and dirty and smoky and exciting as all get out.
And, you know, it's funny. People remember Stonewall. And everybody, if you say Stonewall, even today, oh, I've been there. You know, people that are 40 years old, I was there. But they weren't, because the Stonewall you went to was only open for about 3 or 4 years. A couple of years after the riots, it closed down and became New Jimmy's or something else. And well, then I
went to the real Stonewall. But this guy I stayed with, I got picked up in Detroit by this guy. And then I wound up kind of taking up with his roommate. And I don't want to go into who this roommate is, a rather famous person. And when I went to New York, he flew to New York. And I stayed with him for 2 nights with him in some hotel in New York. And then he was going to leave. And he says, he says, here's the place you should go to. And he says, you should go to Stonewall. And he took me down there and left me there. And he went to catch his plane. And I went to Stonewall. I spent a couple hours. I got picked up by this really cute kid from Columbia. And I wound up staying 3 weeks with him while I was in New York City.
And you may have accidentally met Marsha P. Johnson or somebody, you know, some of the people that became famous with the Stonewall Riot. But of course, you would have known it then because they would have just been locals.
That's right. I still remember the kid who picked me up. His name was Omar Restrepo, really cute kid from Columbia. And I stayed with him and his roommate for 3 weeks in New York. And I had the most fabulous time. I went to a couple other clubs, but the only one I remember is Stonewall.
You probably went to Julia's too, which is like right around the corner, a few blocks away, but who knows?
If I did, I don't remember it. He took me to a number of different places. The only one that stuck in my mind was Stonewall.
Now, did that experience of going to the Stampede and then going to Stonewall, did that kind of set your mind at ease at that point that you were not, you know, a lone wolf somewhere with?
That's why I did the trip. I wanted to find out if I really was gay, and this is what I wanted, and what was a gay community all about. And that's why I made this trip. I was gone for over 3 months, and my parents couldn't figure it out because I left with exactly about $200 or $300 on me, and I never asked them for any more money, because I would go to the bar, I'd get picked up, I would stay with this person, and they'd feed me and house me and the whole bit, so I hardly needed any money to spend anything. But I was just floored by how wonderful it was being gay and how fun gay people were and how much I really was myself finally. So, but that was the whole purpose of the trip, to find out what it was to be gay. And if I really wanted to be gay, and at the end of that trip, I was so thrilled and excited that I was gay. Let me tell you.
If there had been a rainbow flag, then you probably would have had it tattooed on your forehead.
Yeah.
So you had these great experiences traveling the country, visiting gay bars, learning that there was really a gay community. It was not just some oddballs that were, you know, guys having sex here and there. There was actually a community wrapped around it all across the country.
Exactly.
And of course, Dameron's Guide was a big part of that back in those days. I know they started out as being a small, almost little pamphlet kind of thing.
It was the size of a business card. I wish I saved it. It's probably worth a lot of money now. It had a very light blue cover, and it had, you know, about 20 pages inside of it. It was you know, like this, and it easily fit into a pocket. And it was my ticket to a new life.
So after this whirlwind trip across the country, you eventually went back home.
Yeah, I was gone for a few. I went to Chicago, I went to Detroit, I went to Boston, I went to Montreal, I went to Provincetown, I went to Washington, D.C. So it was in every place. I would just pack my stuff in the bus station, go out and get picked up that night and spend the – and it was cool as I would meet all these people's friends and everything and become part of their little community. It was very exciting. I was 21, 22, and it was, I actually wrote all about it, and I was sending it to this, I wrote long pages and pages, and I sent it to this friend of mine in Los Angeles I met at the Stampede, and he saved some of it, and I still have some pages of these very detailed experiences, sexual and everything, as I traveled across country. I wish he saved it all. He only saved some of the pages.
So when you got back home, I guess you decided it was time to enter the real world. And what did you do for the next 10 years or so?
I was in college. I wound up going to, I graduated from California State College of Los Angeles with a degree in zoology. And my professor there, who I worked for, he went up to Humboldt State College and encouraged me to go up there. I was his assistant in Cal State LA, and he said I should come up to Humboldt State and take fisheries biology. I was graduating zoology, and he was a fisheries biology professor. He went up to Humboldt State and taught fisheries biology, and he said I should come up there and get my master's degree up there. So I went up to Humboldt State College, which is in Arcata, California, just a little bit north of Eureka. Eureka is a small town, about 30,000. Arcata is a small town of about 5,000. So there was no gay bars there. But I noticed in one of the restrooms on the campus, people would write their phone numbers on the wall. And that's how I met somebody. But, you know, it's interesting because that's kind of, there was no place for gay people to go in Eureka, California, in the Redwood Empire, Humboldt County. So the first year I met this one guy, and through him, I met several other guys. And so it's a very small community of young people. And when I left for the summer, I went up to Newport, Oregon, where I worked as a seasonal aide for the Oregon Fish Commission. I did scuba diving for them. And I would periodically go into Portland or even Seattle to some of the bars. But when I came back to Humboldt County, I realized there was nothing people do. And I moved into Eureka rather than Arcata, the college town. And I moved to Second Avenue, which is like Skid Row there. And it was and I found this apartment above this vacant store. It was a small two-bedroom apartment with another apartment attached to it that was never occupied. And so I thought I contacted my friend and I said, you know, we should invite some people to come over to my place for a party. And so I had a friend who was a DJ at a local radio station. And he had all the top music back then. So I went over to his house and I made a reel. He got all the music for me. And I made a reel-to-reel tape, a 7-inch reel of all the, you know, the music that was being played on the pop radio stations then. And we invited invited some over, and I told them to bring their friends. And it had on a Saturday night, we had this party there. And it was like a disco in a sense. I had a real, it was just nonstop music playing, and everybody had a great time. And it was the first time anybody ever really had done anything in the Humboldt County with bringing the community together. And everybody says, can you do it again? And so what it turned out for that entire school year from September to June, every weekend, my house became the community center for the gay community center for Humboldt County. And 20, 30 or 40 people would descend on my little two bedroom apartment on Skid Row in Eureka. And it would be like a bar, except of course it wasn't a bar, and everybody would be dancing and partying, this kind of stuff. So this was my first foray into actually running a kind of a nightclub. And it was in Eureka, California. And after I left, everything died down. Nobody did anything.
So then if we fast forward to, about 1978-79, you were up in Portland. You moved up to Portland.
Correct.
And you decided that Portland needed an injection of some kind of fresh blood in the bar scene, in the club scene.
No, that's not it at all. What happened in Portland was I was putting out a newspaper called the Northwest Gay Review. And one afternoon, six young people came in there, teenagers, 17, 18, 19. The lead ringer head was Bill Hicks. And there was a big problem in Portland at that time. It had been going on for years. It was an area called Camp on 3rd and Yamhill, where every Friday and Saturday night, there'd be 100, 125, 150 young people hanging out at the corner. And they never did anything that was, you know, wrong, but you put 100 teenagers on a street corner and everybody panics. And I had been appointed, my newspaper was in the Old Town section of Portland, and I was involved in the community, and I was with the Burnside Community Council, which was the name for that area. And they asked me to be their representative on the Central Police Precinct City, the Central Precinct Citizens Advisory Board. This is, every precinct had a Citizens Advisory Board that provided local community input to the police for that scene street. So at every, just about every meeting of that board that I attended, somebody would come in there and just complain about all these kids on that street corner every Friday and Saturday night. And I was like the token gay. Everyone knew I was gay, although I wasn't appointed by the BCC. I was to represent gay people, but everyone knew I was gay. And so one of the people turned to me at one of those times, Lanny, do you approve of all those kids hanging out there? Because there's no secret that most of them were gay. He said, you approve of all those kids hanging out there in the street corner? And I says, no, I don't. I don't think they should be hanging out there. But you tell me where else they could go. Well, rather than deal with the problem about what we should do to give these place, they just changed the subject. And so I recognized that, you know, something had to be done, but I had no idea what could be done. Well, at around that time, these Bill Hicks and these other kids came into my office and they wanted to open up a club for them to go to, so they wouldn't have to hang out in the streets. They asked if I would run an article in the paper about what they were trying to do. And I said, sure. And I says, by the way, says, if you know, I have about $5,000-$6,000 sitting around here. If you could find a place, I'll help you open it up. And they got all excited and they went out running around looking for a place. They never found a place. So I went to a real estate agent I knew in the area by the name of Jim Atwood. And I says, that's all I wanted to do. And he says, well, Lanny, you know, I have a place in the Pythian building. It's the Pythian Ballroom. And I've leased it out to a rock promoter, but he hasn't paid me rent in 3 months. And if he doesn't pay it in the fourth month, it's yours. Well, the guy didn't pay it, and the place became mine. This was a grand ballroom. It was gorgeous originally. Balcony and all this kind of stuff. And when I went into it, it was just a disaster. Paint peeling, the floor was ruined, everything like that. And but here I was. So I got Bill and these kids. I said, listen, we've got this place for you. Look at it. And they're all excited. And I says, but I don't have, you know, you're going to have to help me fix it up. And so they got together, seven kids. They worked 7 days a week, 10 hours a day, painting and scraping and sanding and fixing this place up. And we got it opened up in 30 days. And it was called Mildred's Palace. It was named after a city council member, Mildred Schwab, who had torpedoed a gay rights bill before the city council. And everyone thought she was a lesbian. She's never married and so forth and so on, a closet lesbian. So we named it after Mildred's Palace. And the day that when that club opened up, the problem of kids hanging out on the street corners disappeared. The city had been working for years and years with social workers and police and all this kind of stuff, trying to clear it up. And in one weekend, I got 80% of the kids off the street there for that. And you would think that the city would have said, oh, this is so wonderful, and given me a key and patted me on the head. But that's not what happened. What happened was that the police were really upset by me because they used to be able to bust lots of kids down there. So what they started to do is they started coming up to my club and they would start busting kids up at the club. And I didn't know what to do about it. And then one night they came with a paddy wagon, about half a dozen cop cars, and they came up to the club and it was a literal police riot. They were knocking kids down, beating them up. Some of the kids were getting bloodied and they hauled them off in the paddy wagon and took them down to jail. And I said, at that point, I have to do something about that. I can't let this go on. So I went to a group called the Portland Town Council. They were the gay civil rights organization at the time. And I told them what would happen. They put me in touch with a guy named Craig Colby, who was one of their lawyers working for him. I went to see Craig and he opened up his law books and went through them and says, They can't do that. They cannot go into a private place and bus kids for curfew. And he wrote a letter they sent to the city attorney saying, you can't do that. That violates the law. And the city attorney agreed with them and told the police to stop it. And that would began the war between me and the police, which lasted for 20 years for the most part. But what happened, because they couldn't come up to the club anymore and bus kids, they had two officers from the juvenile division that would stand out in front of the club every night it was open. And if the kid would walk out that they thought would be under 18, they would accost them and arrest them if they were under 18 for curfew violation. And so consequently, when the club would close normally around 2 o'clock, these kids couldn't leave because they would stay there till 5:30 in the morning until they were able to go out in the street without violating curfew. It was just crazy. So I got one of my big political lessons in my life from that. I went to Commissioner Charles Jordan. He was on the city council and he was in charge of the police bureau. And I went to him and I told him what was going on and he didn't believe me. He says, oh, they wouldn't be doing that. But he said, I'll send one of my liaisons down there to check it out. Well, this liaison went down there and checked it out and went back to him. Yeah, they said, that's exactly what's happening. So I got this call from Commissioner Jordan. He says, come to my office, Lanny, tomorrow at a certain time. We're going to take care of this problem. I go up to his office. He says to me, he says, oh, Lanny, just listen. He gets on the phone and he calls the head of the juvenile division. And he says, listen, this is Commissioner Jordan. I know you've put in for a rather large budget increase for your juvenile division, and I certainly was thinking of supporting it. He says, but I have a big problem with supporting it. If you have the time to have two officers stand in front of this club every single night, Busty gets for curfew. That was the end of it. We never saw curfew officers, the juvenile officers out again. But that was the thing that the police department was in for me, because I really snockered them because of the way they had been busting a lot of kids. If they didn't find them in the streets, they would go into businesses like bowling alleys and this kind of stuff and bust them. And they couldn't do that anymore. So I really caused them a lot of problems and they never forgave me for that. And they did some really horrible things to me over the years.
For people who are unfamiliar with the Portland scene at that time, these clubs that you operated were all age nightclubs that did not serve alcohol. So there was no risk of the kids getting drunk there, at least not because of you. I mean, if they were.
Very true. Well, yeah, kids would get drunk before they came into the club, but they couldn't get drunk after. They would sober up at the club.
Right. So you weren't trying to sneak kids into a 21 and up club. This was an all ages club that had the unique distinction, of course, because it was non-alcohol, being able to stay open later, I'm sure, and have kids of any age in there from 15 or whatever on up.
Yeah, and we had after hours there, and for a while, for several years, all the bars closed at 2 o'clock, so everybody at the bars would come to my club for after hours. We would be open until 4 o'clock in the morning. Eventually, the bars began to say, well, look at all those people going there. We want their business. So they would stay open for after hours. It didn't help them any because they thought they'd sell lots of product after, coffee and this kind. You don't make money selling coffee and Pepsi.
Right.
That's not, yeah, you got to charge a cover charge.
How long was Mildred's open?
Mildred's has opened 2 years, 79. When the lease was up, unfortunately, Jim Atwood had got divorced. His wife got the building and she didn't want to lease it to me. So we had to move.
But you didn't give up.
No, we moved to 3rd and Burnside. That was my beginnings of my association with the Old Town area. And we opened a club called Metropolis.
And Metropolis was basically the same concept as Mildred's. All age club, no alcohol.
Except it did have a section off to the side that actually had a beer and wine license. Under 21 couldn't get into that section. That was just a small section of the club. The major section was no alcohol and any age can get into it.
And how long did Metropolis last?
Well, Metropolis lasted until 83. Now, it never did that well. We had one place try to open up in competition with it. It failed. It was just kind of an expensive operation, and it just was always so borderline financially. And I eventually wanted to just close the club. Bill Hicks, the young man who had enticed me to opening up the clubs in the first place had worked with me all through Mildred's Palace, and it was his creation. Metropolis was a lot of his creation, and he had gotten really into the punk rock scene. And when I says I really want out of it, he said, "Well, let me take it over," and I just gave him the club, and I moved with my boyfriend to Baker, Oregon, to help his parents run their restaurant and motel. And after about, we had been there about 6-7 months, I get this call from him saying that he hasn't been able to pay the loan payments on the club, and they're going to foreclose on the club, and yada 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 yada. And so my boyfriend and I came back, and we took over the club and started running it again. We were able to start making the payments, but it was so marginal. It was just, I don't know, the location wasn't the best. I don't know what it was. We still had some good crowds and stuff, but it just wasn't the same. And so eventually I sold the club. Somebody had turned it into a straight bar. He did make the whole place, you know, beer and wine and this kind of stuff. So I stopped it. And so there was no place for the kids to go anymore. And it was about 6 months, and I kept getting calls from people, and my boyfriend wanted to open up a new club really bad and do it again. And so I said, okay. And we found a new location on 13th and Morrison in an old building called the Danmore Hotel, which is kind of one of these SRO flophouse hotels. And they had this big space under a big kind of, it had been a club, but it had been closed for a number of years. And they rented it to us, very reasonable rent. It was like $500 a month, because nobody wanted to rent it because it didn't have a you know, any kind of alcohol license with it. And they really, I remember one day I was sitting in a restaurant, and the two guys who owned the place were sitting there next to me. And I hear one of them talking to the other. He says, "How in the world could they possibly make a successful club with no alcohol?" Well, the City Nightclub, that's what it was called, was a phenomenal success. It was really an underground club. We didn't even have a sign out front that said City Nightclub. But we used to do these shows. The kids would do these shows every Friday and Saturday night. They started at the Metropolis with shows. That's what actually saved the club. But the club was a phenomenal success. We would have 200-400 kids there every Friday and Saturday night. It was a special place. I mean, you'd have to talk to my customers to understand just how special this club was to all of them. Over the years, I've had so many of them tell me how, you know, it changed their lives. They felt so horrible about being gay, but they came to my clubs and it just totally, you know, they suddenly felt empowered and felt good about themselves for the first time in their lives. I had a number tell me that we were on the verge of suicide, that the club, you know, took that out of them from them. And so the first City Nightclub at the Danmore, they was there for 5 years. And when the lease was up, we decided to move to this other place on 13th and Burnside. And we created this dynamite club that was just incredible. Had two dance floors, a punk dance floor called The Other Side and the main dance floor. We had a lighted dance floor in there. It was a phenomenal club. And I started advertising on television, and we would have lines out the door around the block waiting to get in every Friday and Saturday night. It was a phenomenal club. And like I said, the tightness of the people there was amazing. They had a reunion about 5-6 years ago of the club, and over 300 people showed up at this reunion for the club. And the stories that they told me, it was just incredible. There was nothing else ever like it. I don't think there's anything like it ever in the United States.
Well, fortunately, due to your foresight, there was video from that.
Yes.
There is, yes, a great video that was done by Gregory Franklin, where he does capture the feelings of some of your patrons talking about what it meant to them at the time. And there are also remnants of the commercials that you ran, not the best quality in the world, due to the fact that it's from, you know, 30 odd years ago. But
you have copies of those commercials?
I do. And I'm going to put up a segment of the commercial.
"Mother, I'm going to the City Nightclub tonight."
"You're going to what, dear?"
"I said I'm going to the City Nightclub."
Oh, no, you're not.
Oh, yes, I am.
Oh, no, you're not going to that place. And that's that.
Oh, please. You just don't want me to go because, like, gay people go there.
Oh, now, Don, you know I'm no bigot, but I do know what's best for you.
What? Sitting home with you and Daddy and watching television?
And what's wrong with that?
It is totally boring. I may be straight, but I love the City Nightclub. I can go and dance to the best music, hear great bands, and see outrageous stage shows. And besides, all my very best friends go there.
That may be so, Don, but you're not going to the City Nightclub.
I don't care what you think. I'm going to the City Nightclub.
The City Nightclub, where you'll meet the people your mother warned you about.
We did, at the City Nightclub, the second City Nightclub, we started doing TV shows through Portland Cable Access. And I wound up doing four TV shows every week, four separate shows. And the first show was called Night Scene. And it was kind of like a Tonight Show format where we would start out with a little, my co-host and I would do a little, you know, monologue or dialogue, I guess you would say. And then we would have an entertainer come on, and usually a drag queen or somebody else. It wasn't always a drag queen. And then we would have some guest on. And it would be somebody from the gay community, or it would be a politician. We had the chief of police on. When there was the chief of police, who was a good guy for a few years there, we had this guy named Tom Potter, who was really cool. His daughter was a lesbian, and she became a member of the Board of Police Bureau. While he was police chief, we had no problems with the police. And we did over 500 of these shows. And no, we did not 500. We did a couple hundred, over 100.
I think Greg said there were about 300.
Put down that remote control. Stop that channel surfing. It is the longest running show about gays and lesbians in the history of television. It is Night Scene.
Yeah, well, then we also did, like I said, the customers put on these shows every Friday and Saturday night, these half-hour shows where they would, they're drag shows and this kind of stuff. And we would take these shows. We made another show called Outrageous, another half-hour show, which is kind of a compilation of the two shows on Friday and Saturday night. They would be shown on cable access. Then on top of that, I got asked by one of the people who was in the marijuana activist community if they were trying to get a legalization initiative on the ballot, and they asked me if I would produce a TV show for them. So I said yes, I would, and I came up with Cannabis Common Sense, and this is a show about legalizing cannabis. It was made at the club. And then I had another show. I was a member of a group called United States Atheists. They wanted a show, so I put a show together then called Bunk Bastards. And so here I was producing these four shows in a club that mainly catered to people under 21, under 18. And one was Night Scene, all about how wonderful the gay community was. The other was Outrageous, which really was outrageous. These acts that these kids put on were incredible. And then I was putting on a show about legalizing marijuana. And then I was putting on a show about why God is nonsense. And you can imagine how the community, and there's being shown on cable access every single week. So I was, as far as a lot of people in Portland were concerned, I was not only recruiting for the homosexual community, but I was also pushing drugs. And I was also trying to tell them that Christianity and all religion is bunk, which I was. And the show was, the kids in the club were the ones that were the crews for all these shows. They ran the cameras. They ran the control rooms. They did all the stuff for all these four shows. So it was very controversial.
I'm quite sure. And back in those days, you know, it wasn't as common to have video from the clubs. A lot of the clubs, from anything before 2000, you really don't see much video documentation of the clubs at all.
No, because most gay people were still kind of in the closet.
Right.
And I just couldn't do that. I just pushed it in front of everybody's face. And that was one of the things that was empowering to the kids that were coming to the club. Nobody was apologizing for the fact being gay, except what the fact the club, especially the cities, were such great places that we were better than anything the straight kids had. And they just made them feel so good about themselves, so much better, and so glad that they were homosexual, both the guys and the girls. You know, one of the things that club, the City Nightclub, the second one, became so popular, a lot of straight kids started coming there. And some of the kids were afraid they was gonna be overwhelmed. And so we had this new ruling that at the City Nightclub, no overt heterosexual behavior was allowed. There was a big sign there that said no overt heterosexual behavior allowed. And opposite sex, boys could not dance with girls. You had to dance with members of the same sex. And so we had all these straight kids dancing with the same sex.
Yeah, I remember seeing that sign, I think, in one of the video clips. Yeah. I also remember a slogan that was attached to the City Nightclub that I always thought was kind of amusing. Violating traditional family values since 1983.
That's right. That's right.
So you were really a rebel there. You were not playing by the moral majority rules. You're breaking all the rules.
I was not only playing not by the moral majority, I wasn't playing by anybody. I mean, we were really out in the open. And at a time when that still was not, you know, maybe in some big cities like Los Angeles, and even in Los Angeles or New York, it was still, you know, it was post Stonewall. So people were being more open, but nothing quite like this.
Now, the City Nightclub was around for how long altogether in its two incarnations?
Well, the first location was there for 5 years. From 1983 to 1988, and the second location was 1989 till 95, when we finally got closed down the city. They used drug ordinances to close me down. They sent some cops up there, and you know, we'd have 400 kids there a night, and they eventually found some kids with drugs. Big surprise. So they used that as a drug ordinance to come after me and close me down.
But for a dozen years, you managed to successfully operate a nightclub for all ages with after hours, not serving alcohol for the most part.
20 years, 1977 to 1997. After the city got closed down, we moved to another location, 333 Southwest Park, which somebody used to bill as 666. That's the sign of the beast.
Yeah.
So we were half the sign of the beast anyway. So, cause it was 333 Southwest, and we were there till 97. And at that point, the police really pulled what happened. I finally got out of the business. Was one weekend, 1 week, my boyfriend and I went down to Palm Springs to visit my parents. And I had rented the club out every Wednesday night to this group that did techno night, play techno music. It was mainly straight. And they paid me a good deal of money for a night where it wouldn't have been open anyway. But my DJ, my DJ manager was the one that was running it. And this was at the new location, the Rage. And one night after the club closed at 2 a.m, there was this kid named Casey, who was kind of a exhibitionist. And he was there with my manager, and everybody was gone. And Casey said, gee, let's make a jack-off video. Because I had my whole studio there. I had cameras, and my manager, assistant manager, knew how to run all this stuff. And he thought, hey, that'd be fun to do. Casey was a 16-year-old kid. And so after the club was closed and everybody was gone, he set up a three cameras with the lines all running into the video control room. And Casey got out there and stripped naked and did it and had a lot of fun doing it. You know, it was great fun for him. And I had no. So when I came back that weekend on Friday, I came in and I saw the video control room was open. And I was saying, what's it open? It's not supposed to be open. So I go in there, and there's Casey in the video control room showing this video he had made of him jacking off to his friends. And I looked down there and I said, oh my fucking God, what did you guys do? And I said, so turn it off. And I took out the tape and I didn't know what to do with it. And so I stuck it on the shelf. And on Monday morning, I called my attorney, same guy, Craig Goldley, who originally got the police off my back. And I told him what had happened. He said, come on over. And he once again got all his law books and went through them all. And he said, erase it. And I said, is that okay? I'm not destroying evidence. And he said, no, just go ahead and erase it. It's all right. So I said, okay. Told him to erase it. Well, what happened, unfortunately, was when my setup for doing we had a three camera setup, you know, three cameras. And so you're just like doing a regular, you know, studio. But I couldn't afford these $5,000-$6,000 professional cameras. What I bought was these high eight cameras. They're about $700-$800 each. And they had a line out so you can run a line from the camera all the way to the video control room so they could switch the video, you know, from scenes to scenes and stuff. But the problem is, like these amateur cameras, if you don't have a tape in rolling, the camera shuts off after 5 minutes. So when we did this, we always had a tape in every camera that ran through the whole thing. And you recorded it. And then we would just keep reusing these tapes every time, you know, it would get erased. Well, this is what happened with the guy made the videotape of Casey. And he put the tapes on it. And it was no secret. Casey told everybody about it. So everybody knew about it. So somebody must have known how we did our stuff, because the three tapes apparently were stolen. The three tapes that were in there were stolen. Whoever stole them didn't like my manager, and he took one of the tapes and turned it over to the police department. And here the police department found a videotape made at the club of a 16-year-old jacking off. And they said, great, we have got Swerdlow now. And they got the FBI, they got the Oregon Highway Patrol, they got the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, they got the LA Police Department, they got the special porn unit, and they raided the club. And they took all the video equipment out, they stopped the marijuana show, they took everything out, all the tapes and everything, and for good measure, they raided my home. I lived on a houseboat back then. At 8 in the morning, 24 cops came busting in through the front door. I was in bed naked with my boyfriend. They got us up. We were standing there naked for 15 minutes until they decided that we could put clothes on. And then they marched us out of the place, and they just rounded up everything in the houseboat. Now, interestingly enough, what happened? A friend of mine, Dave Evans, who was the guy who put Night Scene together for me, he used to work for Oregon Public Broadcasting. He was the first director. And we were very close friends. And I used to always go out to his house, but whenever he was gone, I'd go stay in his house, which I love this one. Dave, unfortunately, contracted AIDS. And when he died, he left me the houseboat. So we moved in there. And one of the things David did was there's a thing called the Northwest Children's Theater. And what the Northwest Children's Theater was this thing that they did, that where they would have these children would come in and make these productions of Hansel and Gretel and, you know, Cinderella and this kind of stuff. And parents would pay for their kids to take these acting classes. And so after each month, each of the classes would produce this, would do a show, you know, Cinderella, Puss in Boots, this kind of thing. And David would videotape them. And then they would sell the videotapes for like $25 each. And David would give the money to Northwest Children's Theater, and they would use the money, which would be several thousand dollars, to give scholarships to children that couldn't afford to pay the tuition to go into the school. So after David died, I mean, I had all his equipment. He left me everything. And they asked me if I would continue to make these videos for him. I said, sure, I would. And so I had about five slave VCRs. So I'd make the video and then I would put it in there, and I'd have all these slave VCRs and make, you know, I'd make 20, 30 copies, 40 copies of every show and sell them and give the money to the Northwest Children's Theater. Well, here the cops come in here, and here they see all this video duplication equipment. And what of all this? It says Northwest Children's Theater on it. They thought they had gotten the bonanza. proof that I was making child porn. Well, of course, I wasn't. And but on top of that, my friend David had been going to, this would have been back in the 80s. Well, this would have been the 90s. They raided me, but when he was doing it in the 80s, he was going to these video stores and going into the adult section and renting all these 70s gay porn stuff. And he would take it home and he record them on beta for the most part. That's how old it was. And he had like 300 or 400 of these tapes of this old gay porn stuff. So the police took this, which we refer to as the David Evans Memorial Gay Porn Collection. They took all these tapes. They took all these, I had these, you know, hundreds of children's theaters tapes, confiscated all my equipment. And eventually I got everything back. But every single tape had a barcode on it and a notation. So some FBI agent or sheriff, I don't know who, went through every single, there must have been, close to 700-800 tapes between the children's theaters tapes and the David Evans Memorial, went through every single tape looking for child porn. I don't know how many hundreds of hours, thousands and thousands of dollars of taxpayers' money went into spending this, trying to find this. And they did it to go after me. And, you know, for years, I had been going to the press, the media, the Oregonian, the TV station, and I say, look what's going on at my club. You know, these young gay people there who feel so bad about being gay, and they're ostracized in the school and all this kind of stuff. They've been coming to my club. They produce these shows. It's empowering to them. Come here and do a story about what we're doing. They never, after all those years, never did. But this raid of my club, banner headline in the Oregonian, child porn raided at youth nightclub. It was the lead-in story on every broadcast and television media. Years, they wouldn't touch me. But this, suddenly, it was everywhere. Of course, nothing ever came of it. I didn't have any child porn. And what's so strange is that the guy who actually, my manager, who made the videos, they never touched him. They didn't care about that. This whole thing was to go after me. And it was just incredible. And I finally just couldn't take it anymore. The club wasn't that successful. So anyway,
so they,
that's what they did.
They never pressed any charges against you. They never.
I mean, all the equipment was returned to me. There wasn't anything. There never was, except for the one tape that I never had. That one little tape, 8mm tape that was in the one of the cameras, there wasn't anything. Of course, they couldn't press anything out. I mean, they gave me all the stuff back.
But nonetheless, you made a huge impression on the Portland youth gay scene.
Oh, absolutely.
20 years. And I know there's a couple of Facebook pages still talking about it.
They still do. The fact that the gay social service thing which was called the Phoenix Rising, I think it was called. They used to get so pissed because they would do these things for gay youth, and maybe 10, if they had 10 people show up for them, it'd be a phenomenal success. And every Friday, Saturday night, I had 300-400 kids coming to the place. Let me tell you another thing that really kind of ticked me. When I had my first city nightclub, that was in the early 80s. And that was when the AIDS crisis really began, and everybody was groaning about it. And so I went to it was Portland AIDS Coalition. I can't remember the name of the AIDS group that was doing it. And I went there and said, hey, they were going around to the bars and stuff and doing these seminars, teaching people about using condoms and how not to get AIDS and all this kind of stuff. And I went to him, I says, you need to do this for my customers here. These are all young kids and they're all sexually active. They were coming down to the club because they wanted sex. I mean, this was a gay club. It wasn't a church. It wasn't a school. It was a gay club. They were coming down there because they wanted to meet guys for sex. And they wouldn't come. They were afraid. They said, oh no, we might get busted for putting a condom on a dildo. They would rather these kids get AIDS and die, than take the chance of crossing the law and possibly being accused of providing sexual material to kids. Unbelievable. Finally, after nagging for 6 months or more, they went to the Multnomah County District Attorney, and he said, no, go ahead and do it. We won't bust you. And so they held the thing, and over 200 customers showed up. It was the largest event they ever made a presentation to on AIDS prevention. And they did it a couple times after that. But this is the kind of thing, even the gay community was having mixed feelings about what I was doing. So much so that the AIDS organization was afraid to come here and talk sexuality. And the club was all about sex. I mean, I never made many bones about that. That's what it was. It was a gay club. It was sex. And that's just, you know, the minute you talk about sex and 18-year-olds or 16-year-olds, everybody just freaks out. And they still do.
Your club was, it's billed as all ages. And from the pictures that I've seen, it seems like most of the patrons were teenagers.
Anywhere from 80% of the customers were under 21. We had, you know, after they turned 21, they would still keep coming to the club for a while because their friends were still there. But eventually they would stop. We did have, there was a small crowd, not as big, of people who were alcoholics that liked to go and dance and party. They couldn't go to the bars because they couldn't be around alcohol. So they would come to our place to party and dance because they wouldn't be tempted.
And I kind of wish we would have another one of those type clubs open up in some of the major cities around the country, even in this day.
There used to be, you know, there was one in Seattle. There's a place called Peanuts in Los Angeles for a while. And back in the, when I was coming out, there was a place called Giovanni's. They were never really great clubs. The one in Seattle was a pretty good, cool club though. But now there isn't any, there isn't any, but you know, it's a different world now. The bars themselves don't do as well as they used to because of the internet. You know, if you want sex, remember, most of the kids coming down to my club are coming down because they want to meet people for sex. And well, they want to, you know, friendship and all this kind of stuff too. But the bottom line of any gay bar is sex. And nowadays, it's much easier to find a sexual mate on the internet than having to go down to a bar, get dressed up and hang around there drinking and hope you can run into me. So it's just... the club, the necessity of the club, like it was back then, isn't there now.
Well, and on top of that, I think society is a lot more accepting now in general. So a lot of these kids that might have been really freaked out at 16, 17 years old, they now have more resources.
I mean, high schools have gay straight alliances on the campuses.
So it's now a different world.
It's a different world. Absolutely.
At that time, it was salvation for a lot of these kids. It was their, you know, their community center. It was the only place they could go to be who they were.
And absolutely. I wish you could have come to this reunion they had about 5-6 years ago and talked to these people. A lot of them tell me that it was the best time of their lives. There was nothing else. They look back in those years when they were going to my club as the most exciting, the absolutely best time of their lives. Everything else has been a day to me.
Amazing. You made a remarkable impression on the gay community in the Northwest with that. And I've heard people talking about it. Many who have been there, but some who have never been there and just heard about it. It's like some kind of fable or something. It's like, everybody seems to know about City Nightclub, even if they're 25 years old now, and we're never able to go there. They still know the history of it and the story of it. So you did a great job with that.
Yeah, because these people who went there talk about it. It was such an important part of their lives back then. And it was really exciting. I mean, you have to have been in the atmosphere. I mean, it was, you know, imagine all these essentially, you know, teenagers, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, and, you know, just hormone laden, you know, remember what it was like, what were you like when you were 17, 18? And it was just, it was the excitement level, the energy level was just And they weren't drunk. I mean, they would come, some of them would drink before they come there, but they would sober after a while. And it was I would be there and I'd be looking out on the dance floor. There'd be 200 kids on the dance floor dancing. And it was just the most empowering. I would think, boy, when I was that age, what I would have given to have been able to experience what those kids are doing, because I was just miserable when I was 15, 16, 17, 18. And because I was in complete denial of who I was. And these kids didn't, they had this opportunity that I never had.
Right. And you were in a city that was much more liberal. Imagine what Portland was like when you were a teenager.
Well, I didn't grow up in Portland. I grew up in Los Angeles.
I know. That's what I'm saying. Your teen years were in a city that was already known to be somewhat liberal and have more of a gay lifestyle, even at that time.
Back in those days, people were still gay. When I was going to the bars in 68, 69, people were still getting busted. Police would come into a gay bar and they would go, you, and you, and they would pull them out. And then this happened. One of the ones I got a call from a friend one night who had gotten busted in one of these raids. I never got busted. I had a friend go. He said, "What am I going to do? I'm in jail, Lanny." And I says, "Well, I said I can bail you out. You can wait in the morning, and then they have to arraign you, and they'll let you go. You know, you have whatever." And he said, "Okay." So I went down there that morning for his arraignment, and I had never seen anything like it. I swear, 30 or 40 or more. I mean, there's a whole bunch of these guys who were just paraded before this judge. And every single one of them was charged with the exact same thing, groping the police officer. And they were all going to be told they're going to be charged with some kind of sexual misconduct or something like that. However, if they would plead guilty to public disturbance, they would reduce they would give them a 1-year suspended sentence and a $100 fine. And so everybody pleaded guilty, of course, because they didn't want to get, you know, go up for a sex charge, except for my friend. He just burst out into tears before the judge, said, "I didn't do it." And the judge dismissed the charges against him. And as he walked out, everybody kind of applauded him. But this is what they did. Every time you went to a gay bar, you wouldn't know if the person standing next to you was a cop or not. And it got a little looser. I remember there was a bar that opened up in the City of Industry, I think it was. It was a warehouse, big warehouse district. And we went down there because we heard they allowed dancing, because none of these bars back when I was going would allow dancing. You couldn't dance. And they were allowing dancing. So we went down there, and sure enough, they were dancing. And it was great fun. We were dancing, except in the middle of the dance floor was this kind of platform. And on top of the platform was the security guard. And he would have his flashlight. And if you touched somebody, he would shine the flashlight on you and say, "Don't touch." But that was the kind of dancing we had back then. It was so liberating dancing. But what really is amazing about a number of years ago, 10 years ago, I don't know, now back when I was in Portland, I went down to do my night scene show. I'd sold the club. I kind of changed it over to night scene. I kept doing it, but I kind of made it a documentary thing. And we went down to Los Angeles. Well, that'd be that. LA started having their gay pride parades. And what was so interesting is the pride parades would start out with the dykes on bikes. And who was following the dykes on bikes? The Los Angeles Police Department was now marching in the gay pride parade. The same fuckers that would go into the bars and bust us and try to ruin our lives were now marching in our parades. And all I can say is that shows how much progress we have made.
I want to thank you for the work you did with the City Nightclub in Portland and bringing a safe scene for the gay youth in Portland, into that town. And the impact you had on that community, as well as your work that you've been doing on marijuana legislation. You just made some great contributions over the years, and I'm glad to see that you're still at it and still out there kicking and fighting and doing.
I'll have to be honest. It's fun. I've had it very exciting, and it's been rewarding and very exciting. It's, you know, I don't look back at my life and say, "Wow, how dull." it's been really exciting.
And that concludes another segment of the Gabe Archives podcast. You can find more podcasts at gabearchives.com/podcast. We also have